Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop, which happens to be my bookshop, and we just won an award for Best Bookshop in Philadelphia. I'm really pleased with that and proud of it. Today, we're lucky enough to have with us James Hanaham, author of Delicious Foods, which was published in March by Little Brown and Company. James is a writer of, as he said on his website, of what? His stories have appeared in The Literary Review, Open City, and Nerve, Significant Objects in One Story. He's received fellowship from the McDonald Colony and other fellowships. His first novel, God Says No, came out through McSweeney's, which is my favorite, in late May of 2009. And as James says, you know, McSweeney's is like one of the last companies that actually their books look like books are supposed to look like. And this one does too. It looks like kind of a yearbook. He's also written reviews and profiles for The Village Voice, Spin, Blender, Barnes & Noble Review. And this today we're going to be talking about is his new novel, Delicious Foods. So, James, thanks so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure having you.
Hi. I hope we have some time after that introduction.
Well, did you not want me to say anything about you?
No, I'm kidding.
Well, anyway, so I like talking about covers. I like talking about epigraphs. And your epigraph in this book is an interesting one. Why don't you tell us what it is?
It just says, the worm don't see nothing pretty in the robin's song.
And when you read that, you know that the prey is not particularly interested in how nice and pretty and how pleasant the predator is. And that, you know, kind of encapsulates to a certain extent what the book is about. And also what I found fascinating too, and I wanted to ask you about, is the cover, which is beautiful and kind of tells a lot about the book. It has one of the birds that appear over and over again, which is a grackle, which is kind of a blackbird. And I was wondering how you came up with that as, in fact, in between your paragraphs and, you show a picture of one. So
yeah.
Why is that?
I lived in Austin for 3 years, and there's a particular kind of long-tailed grackle that is very present in like the street life of the city, and they're very strange. They look really sleek and elegant, and they have this way of looking at you as they walk around that's like, you went out in that? You know, you really feel like they're judging you. And they can be very like aggressive. There was this one cafe where like they would whenever they serve like corn chips, the grackles would come down and like land next to you on a chair or whatever and just like try to jump into your lunch or whatever. And they make this very, very strange sound. I describe it a little bit in the book that it's like a broken radio. They don't sound like a bird. And so I started by writing this thing about the grackles, and then I kind of thought of them as like a sort of, I don't know, I had this fantasy myself, actually, that they were like within these birds was like, you know, the souls of disgruntled black folks who had come back and they were like looking down at everybody and be like, "Her." So and it fit very well with the themes of the book. And so I kind of decided to keep it going in various ways. And one of the things I do as I'm writing is that I try to economize. Like if something has come up before and it seemed useful, like I'll bring it up again or I'll have like some way, I enter the book in some other way. And so that was just one of the things that just kind of kept coming up.
Yeah, it's so funny because the way you described it is somewhat, in my mind, what it was they were like folding their wings like you'd fold your arms, like looking at you, just shaking their head. No, you know, that ain't right. And it's like, No, it's like you said, you woke up this morning and you go, I think I'll wear these yellow plaid pants with this brown shirt. I think that's a good look.
Like, no, you didn't. But, you better get back in that house.
But also, it kind of reminds me, I mean, if we are going to talk about the book, we got to talk about three people. Eddie, who has no hands on the first page and is driving a car, and Darlene, his mommy, who's got all kinds of issues. But the third protagonist
is not a person.
Is not a person. You can tell us about the third protagonist, and I want you to tell us, too, about, because I've seen it in so many of the interviews, about how he had one voice at first, and then you thought, no, that ain't going to work. So tell us that part, too.
Well, Scotty is, for all intents and purposes, the voice of crack cocaine. And the way that that voice ended up in the book was that originally I was writing a close third person on Darlene, who was addicted to drugs at the moment when I was writing about her experience. And then as I kept writing, and it was, you know, it's this very, like, colloquial, like, sort of, you know, foul-mouthed, very funny, I think, voice that was kind of fun to write. And at a certain point, I decided that I wanted Darlene to be a different sort of person and sort of much further away from that voice than I originally intended her to be. Like, the voice was originally maybe, you know, her sort of her voice, but, like, with a little bit of distance. But then I decided that she would be somebody else, but I still had this voice that I was, like, still wanted to use and still wanted to write. The same, you know, I'm coming back to this idea of economy, right? Like, I don't really want to, you know, reimagine everything about the book, or if I can repurpose it. So I had to say to myself, well, if it's not Darlene, well, who is it? And among the things that I thought was, it's the drug. And I thought, maybe no one was going to really like that. And then I thought, oh, Victor Laval will like that. And then that sort of gave me permission to keep going with it.
Yeah, because you thought about doing it in kind of a patrician type of voice, almost like condescending or something.
Well, that came a little bit later when I was questioning whether or not I really thought it was a good idea to have, you know, Scotty have this black dialect kind of voice. And I was like, does it have to be that? And I was like, well, what else could it be? And I had this idea that, oh, well, maybe crack is pretentious. Maybe crack, you know, is like one of those people who went to England for 2 months
right.
and comes back with a British accent.
Like Madonna. Yeah, like a Madonna.
Well, you know, she's not the only one who's ever done it. But
true.
She's maybe the most high profile. And so I toyed around with this idea that, you know, crack really wanted to be, you know, taken seriously and kind of more like his sister, cocaine. But it kind of wasn't working. And it wasn't as fun. And it didn't feel as, like, you know, naughty even as just going with that other idea.
Well, the funny thing is that, like, if you look at all three of them, I mean, Eddie, you know, he's good. He's a good guy. He's got a lot of good things going for him. He's smart. He's resilient. He accepts challenges, those kinds of things.
I mean, you're putting it quite mildly. I think he's a kind of an exceptional person.
Yeah, he is, considering, you know, what he's done the first few pages of the book. It's an amazing acceptance of a deficit that should not be there or should not be there. And then Darlene, you know, I'm constantly so upset with her for so many things she does in so many different ways. It's like, all right already, enough of this. And then Scotty, I'm thinking, well, I should hate Scotty the most. But the problem is, Scotty just wants people to love him. And he wants to love people. And so it's like a sleight of hand on your part.
I mean, that's kind of what, I guess, if drugs had consciousness, that might be their whole modus operandi, right? You know, I just want people to have a good time. I just want them to love me, you know, but I want to be number one.
Yeah, and then he gets angry if, you know, you abandon him.
Right.
Yeah, he has this, you know, separation anxiety.
You know, kind of psychotic, actually. He's like a really bad friend, actually. Like a friend who's really demanding and wants you to be there all the time, and won't let you go, you know, do things that you really should be doing, like taking care of your son, for example.
Yeah, I never really thought of a drug addiction as kind of being a codependency. But
my God, yeah.
Yeah, but that's what
well,
it is.
Well, I mean, only because drugs don't have the consciousness necessarily, but like if you put like a consciousness into the mix, it would seem that that's what I got anyway.
Yeah, and I got it too, because it bothered me. It bothered me that I was feeling this way towards Scotty and feeling a lot worse towards Darlene.
Yeah.
And what's also really fascinating about the book is that, you know, you have these three protagonists, but you also have these corollary peripheral characters that are really painted broadly and strongly, like whether you're talking about Bethella or Nat, who's kind of like the absent hero of this book, or horrible people like Hal and Jackie, and then great people like Sirius B. I know my listeners don't know this, but sometimes I read the book, I want to hear about it. and Sextus, who's really well drawn out. So I was fascinated by the way you were able to keep these people, like juggling all these people together. And like you said at the outset, there's not a lot, well, when we were talking before, it's not like there's spoilers here, because you jump back and forth and it's not really like constrained by time or place.
Well, it moves around in terms of information more than in terms of time. So like the cumulative information that you're getting is kind of what pulls you through the book, hopefully. And then the sort of the fact that you don't know exactly how Eddie lost his hands is part of that.
Yeah, and it's like the mystery is, I mean, you don't bury the punchline. The punchline's right there, first page.
Right.
And that's what makes it fascinating for the reader, because the rest of the book, he's got to keep that in the back of his head so he remembers that this is like one of the most important things. Also, I've talked so much now that I haven't given you a chance, since we're here to sell your book, I haven't given you a chance to tell us what your book's about. It's delicious food, and what is the book about?
It's about Eddie and Darlene and the way in which Darlene's drug addiction, which is partially sparked by the murder of her husband, who is a community activist in rural Louisiana, how she goes into this spiral of despair and drug addiction, and it leads her to take a job, or what she thinks is a job, at this farm called Delicious Foods, or maybe something else, but it's because it's a shell company. And it's unfortunately a scenario that is not fictitious entirely. It's the sort of scheme that has been run a bunch of different times, usually in Florida, where a corrupt farm will like go out looking for people they think will not be missed, like drug addicts and homeless people, and they will convince them that there's a wonderful job in this, you know, agricultural setting, and you know that there are all these amenities, and then they get there and they discover it's a completely different idea, and that these people are telling them they owe money for the transportation, and that they have to pay to be there, but that they'll work it off, and then, you know, gradually they may come to the realization that they are enslaved, even though there is this thing in their mind that they have this debt that they have to pay off. That's most of what happens to Eddie and Darlene, but there's a lot of other stuff.
So you have to have been asked this lots of times, but I own a bookstore, so because it's Delicious Foods, when it comes into the bookstore from Baker & Taylor or Ingram or your publisher, whoever, half the people are going to think it's a cookbook. So how do I, how have you dealt with that?
I don't think that has been a huge problem. And I feel like even if people do pick it up thinking it's a cookbook, if they read it, they'll immediately know that it's not, for one thing. And then once they read it, I think they'll have a different idea of what the phrase means.
Yeah, and whether it's good or bad, you can tell people 1,000 times they are going to judge a book by its cover. All my customers do. And the cover is really good, like we talked about. And you know, kind of encapsulate a certain portion of the book. So no, I say that facetiously, but you know, it is a title that, you know, might imply something else. But no, I agree with you 100%.
So, I know. I feel like not enough people complained about it for me to change it.
No, it's, you know, especially because when you said it's a shell company, you know, because what it sounds like, like Jackie portrays it when she dumps these people into the car. It sounds like mm-hmm. this is a beautiful, heavenly-like place with, you know, a three-star hotel and all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that was difficult to read in this book was, like, things like when you describe what happened to Nat in great detail, or when you describe the violence and the way it occurred at Delicious Foods. And it was hard to read, especially with regard to Nat's death. But why did you do it that way? Why did you think it was necessary to paint such a very clear and, I guess, scary picture?
Well, I mean, it's interesting you say that that Nat's death is more, was harder to read than certain other parts, because that part is actually not narrated in real time. Like, you never actually are within that scene.
No, you aren't.
Somebody else tells Eddie about what happened much later, and you get intimations of what must have happened at certain moments in other chapters. But that's the one that I really didn't go for. There, I mean, there's other stuff in there that's pretty difficult slash brutal. I think I was kind of picking up on things that are kind of in the culture at large. I wanted to write the book. I felt as if I wanted to really examine, you know, what discrimination was like, I had to deal with dismemberment on some level, because I think that is the ultimate, you know, expression, I think, of oppression by one group on another, right? Like, they believe that they own you to the extent that they can do whatever they want to with your body.
Yeah.
And that your body is just... So I felt like there had to be this, like, visceral connection to discrimination. And I know that's, like, difficult material, but I also feel like, you know, if you can watch Zero Dark Thirty or, like, any of these violent movies that are going... If you can watch Saw, you could get through this book. I think it's just that there are sort of real issues underneath some of these things that I think are just as scary as anything I'm actually describing that's, like, you know, violent.
Well, maybe that's why it's so disturbing. And I lived in Florida for a long time, and I know what you're talking about with regard to mm-hmm. these places. Or even if you go back into the 1800s and you talk about company towns and people working for the railroad and trying to get out of the town and not being able to do it. You know, it's a horrible way of dehumanizing someone. So I think now I kind of understand a little bit more. But, you know, then you have characters like, if you want to go into the hero kind of motif, if you have characters like Sirius B, who was one of the fellow slaves, inmates, community members at Delicious Foods, who decides he's going to take a different journey than everybody else there. And he was a very well-drawn character who returns from time to time to make a big difference in the tale.
I mean, I love all of these characters, by the way.
So
I think
do
it's
I.
really important to kind of love all your characters, no matter who they are. And even the, you know, even the really minor people, like the guy who's Darlene's boss at the convenience store, like, that guy is great. I love that guy.
Yeah, that was a good scene.
And Sirius B is kind of the spiritual center of the book, I think, in a lot of ways. I don't know exactly what to say about him that won't, like, give too much away.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to dance around it. You don't have to. Let's move on to Sextus. Sextus is like the owner of the plantation in Cool Hand Luke, with just a little more sophistication, I think. What we have here is a lack of communication, that kind of deal. But
I suppose, you know, sort of while I was writing him, I was thinking a little bit about George W. Bush.
Oh, good. But he's a lot...
At a certain point, I realized that the staff at Delicious Foods sort of reminded me of the Bush administration. Like, Jackie could be Condi. And, I mean, there's no Dick Cheney... But
no, there's no one to.
How could be Alberto Gonzalez? And, you know, Sextus would be W.
Well, if Scotty was meaner, he could be he could be Dick Cheney. But the no, Sextus is way smarter than George Bush.
Well, I mean, you know, but I meant in the ways that he reminds me of W in that, okay, W, he's like, you know that he's, his motivations are not good, but he tries so hard to be charming.
Yes.
You know, and I don't think that that charm is completely off the mark all the time.
No, and
there's
that's
something, there's yeah. something about that that seems sort of tragically disgusting to me.
Yeah, well, that's when I didn't like Darlene again at the very end of her interaction with Sextus, because, and then Sextus became also like when he's at the very end, when he kind of says, you know, what he says, it's like I'm thinking, well, there's a part of him that just says, you know what, I can live with this or whatever. And she's looking at his eyebrows. I mean, I'm obviously no one who's listening knows what I'm talking about, but I don't care. But don't you see what I mean?
Well,
I mean,
hopefully it'll be intriguing.
It is intriguing. I mean, yes, I can see how it would be intriguing, because there's this relationship between Darlene and Sextus, and it's all convoluted, and Eddie gets involved in it. And you must have been, I can just see you sitting there at your desk kind of leaning back, pondering with your pencil tip, if that's what it was. Or, you know.
Actually, I wrote a lot of the book while lying down.
Really?
I'm not kidding. Like, this odd thing happened while I was at a residency. It's sort of hard to explain, but the room was too hot where I was working, except that it was connected to a linen closet with a blower for the air conditioner, and it was in the middle of the summer. So, like, I went into the closet, and there wasn't a chair, so I just, like, lay down on the carpet. And then I started realizing that, oh, I'm actually writing better, or something's happening here. And so it just became a habit after a while of, like, lying down while writing this book, and for some reason I got better stuff while lying down.
Well, it sounds kind of like the chicken coop. I mean, it's really hot, and you're lying down on the cot, and, you know, yeah, it's a little
yeah bit. I was talking to this performance artist one time, this guy who calls himself Pope L now, I think he was William Pope L at the time, but he has this whole thing about verticality versus horizontality and the meaning of, like, someone being upright and upstanding and, you know, is much different than somebody being horizontal, and, you know, like, there's all the things we do that are, like, human and maybe embarrassing, you know, sex and sleep and crawling, and those kind of things are things that are, like, you know, more of the earth, I guess, than, you know, walking upright. And he's the guy who puts on a Superman costume and has been crawling up Manhattan for many years.
I think I actually know who you mean.
He's great.
Well, so when you did you come up? Did you first think in your mind, or had you read some commentary or some expose with regard to, you know, kind of like The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, something like that in your mind, and that's what gave rise to the kernel of the book, or was it something?
Oh, I mean, there's a very specific story from a book called Nobodies by a guy named John Bow.
Uh huh.
That came out in 2007, I believe. There's a story in there. That book is about a variety of human trafficking, modern slavery cases around the world. And one of them was the story of this woman named Joyce Grant, who was a slave, essentially, in Florida in 1992. And that was, like, my first, like, slap in the face with regard to modern slavery, and I was like, I lost my mind. I was like, what? Not only is this happening in the same place, but to the same demographic, like, what on earth is going on that this can still happen in our century, in our, I guess it's not our century anymore, but, in, you know, in our world? I mean, is there some eternal thing about human nature that makes us want to enslave other people? And it was just the book is the response, you know, the continued response to that knowledge, that the news of that particular story.
Yeah, and the book is set in the 70s, really. And
well, it's It's from the 70s to the 2000s.
Yeah, I guess that's true, yeah. But
it hops around a lot.
But also tied in with the 70s is the book is involved a lot with music and the culture of music and the singing of music, too. How did that come in?
Well, I mean, I was a rock critic for a long time.
Oh.
And I still have sort of that thing in the back of my head and, you know, a sort of catalog of stuff about music and about the pop music in particular. For some reason, Scotty was really into disco.
I know.
I really don't know exactly. It doesn't quite map onto the history of crack cocaine, but I figured it would be the phenomenon that drug would be most sort of in line with. And if Scotty is in some ways a manifestation of like what might have been going on in Darlene's head, then I think Darlene would have known all those songs, and that might have been part of why the disco thing sort of works with Scotty.
Well, it's close to Studio 54. I mean, not exactly, but you know, that's where.
No, it really started in the mid 80s.
What, disco?
Crack.
Oh, crack. Okay. Yeah. Well, it's yes.
And by then, disco was kind of a memory.
That's true. Yeah, I remember in our office, Donna Summers being played, and my brother went in and turned it off. Yeah.
But it felt like a good fit, so I stuck with it.
Yeah, it was a good fit. And it was also a good fit when they were in that garage where Eddie was replacing light bulbs. Was it who started singing? Was it Teet? Who was it? It started singing and then...
Tuck. I mean,
yeah,
Tuck is a character who was a blues musician, or is a kind of fading, you know, almost over blues musician. And he brought a whole other sort of set of circumstances and musical history into the book that I thought was kind of useful.
Yeah, and just like in the times of real slavery, this is close enough, you know, Hal and the other overseers, if you want to call them that, were upset because the music actually was an indication that there was a survival instinct and that the people on the farm actually were able to cope with it to a certain extent, and they didn't like that, but they didn't know what to do about it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I feel like I was trying to find ways to confuse time a little bit, and one of them had to do with, you know, you keep referring to a lot of what happens on the farm as like a plantation, and using the overseer. I conceive of it as like taking place in the modern era, right?
It would be
all of these roles are still kind of with these people in this place. I was kind of trying to overlay the past onto something a little more contemporary, and from the way you're relating to it, I think it maybe have worked a little too well.
Well, no, it didn't, because, I mean, it would have been, I would not be using these terms if they abducted white people along with the people that they were abducting.
Hmm.
Right?
Well, I mean, I'm teasing definitely that interpretation. And it should feel as old-timey as it does contemporary.
Yeah. Well, it does, especially with Nat. I mean, yeah, definitely. It's a combination of things, especially because he's a Vietnam vet and stuff like that. So you're thinking,
yeah,
this shouldn't be happening now. But, and it's almost like, you know, it's almost like the uppity words. You know, you do. It does draw back and then it brings it forward, which is fascinating because I think it gives people misgivings, whether they're white or they're black, you know? But white people were just as forgettable. You know, there's white people on the street that are just as forgettable as the people who are, you know, put in the van to go to delicious foods.
Oh, yeah.
There's lots of them.
Yeah. But I was interested in this particular scheme, let's call it. And a lot of the research I did was focused pretty much on this phenomenon of, like, the farm that... They call them crackhead crews.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And they would deliberately find people who were mostly black but not exclusively.
Hispanics you have in the book.
Yeah. And transport them to these places and then, you know, exploit the heck out of them.
Jackie.
My interest in it had a lot to do with its connection to the past and to chattel slavery of the past.
Jackie was a very interesting character because she had this veneer, especially, and I was even taken in by it when they first get in the car, that only gradually dissipated those first few days. And then it became clear that she wasn't that much different in a lot of ways.
Yeah, she's very high functioning.
Yes.
Which is one reason why I think she rose in the ranks. I mean, it doesn't take much, I guess, among a crew of crackheads to be seen as high functioning. But she seemed like, I guess, to the higher ups, that she seemed like somebody they could use to look over other people, despite the fact that she was also an addict.
And at some point in the book, there is a certain, retribution scene section, but it was almost like I wish there had been more punishment. And it almost seemed as if you wished to convey that too. There were a couple of lines there that made it seem like, you know, this is what they're being called on, but this is not really what they should be called on. And then it was
sadly, that's sort of true to life.
Yeah. It is.
In a lot of these cases, there have not been laws on the books that have been specifically geared toward human trafficking. I mean, that's starting to change, but not fast enough. And so the way that several of these cases have been tried is that, you know, the people responsible have also been doing something else that's shady that is on the books. And so they managed to get them on that instead of, you know, the thing that they've really been, you know, the more egregious thing that they've been doing.
Yeah, it's like when somebody's charged and convicted of mail fraud when in actuality they did something a lot worse than mail fraud.
Right, and that, you know, that sort of has the disappointing texture of life to me.
Yeah.
Like, it just, I mean, I know that that's kind of how people want things to resolve, and, you know, of course I want them to resolve that way too, but I think it's more interesting that things resolve in ways that are oblique or, you know, off in some way. They're not, like, it's kind of resolving, but there are no magic bullets, right? It's like this thing, it's okay that it happened the way that it did, but it's also kind of also disappointing that things work the way they do.
And I think that's why, I don't know, suppose this book is picked, you know, we have like tons of book clubs at the bookstore. So suppose this book is picked as a book club selection, which no doubt it will be around the country.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah, it will be. And so you're gonna have people reaching across the table, throttling each other, saying whether Darlene was the person who could do what she did at the end of the book. Was she this horrible person? Was Eddie, you know, was he right in the end the way he handled the situation with his mom? Did Nat do the right thing in attempting to, you know, establish something that might have been a little bit more, that was more than, he bit off more than he could chew. So I can see that. And that's why when you say it's disappointing, some people who are listening are like, oh, it's disappointing. But it's not disappointing in a disappointing way. It's that it gives rise to a lot of thought on the reader's part, which always gives rise to the question in my head, which is when you finish this book and you let it go out into the world, was it like letting go of a child, like your baby, you know, that kind of feeling?
It took a long time before I knew that I couldn't work on it anymore. That was really what happened. It was like, you know, it was going back and forth a lot between myself and my editor. And at a certain point, you know, the deadline comes up and it's just, you can't alter it any more than you've altered it. Between the time that you deliver it and the time it shows up as an actual book. So, you know, you just kind of like hope that you've done your best and grin and bear it if you haven't.
So have you been going out on tour and talking to people and stuff like that yet?
Yeah, I
guess you have.
I was on tour for a lot of the end of March and the middle of April.
Right, I forgot it was March 17th.
I went to about 11, 12 different cities and read in various bookshops.
Did you get a lot of emotional attachment from readers? I'm kind of fishing for this, I guess, but it seems to me, it was to me a very emotional experience reading this book. And it's difficult, but it's pleasant at the same time. It's pleasant in a strange way. And I wonder
it feels great to know that you can care, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I feel like that's, you know, that's one of those things that is really important to me. Like, I want to break people's hearts, basically.
Thanks a lot.
You know, with something. It's a friend of mine used to say this all the time. Like, I want a book to break my heart.
And yeah, I have a lot of friends.
Everything else is like TV.
I have a lot of friends who like books that end where a box and the box is wrapped up and then it's got a ribbon around it and it's handed to you. And this isn't that kind of book at all.
No, it was never going to be that kind of a book.
There's books that do really well like that.
I'm capable of writing that kind of a book.
But it's like when I was saying at the outset, when you have like his aunt Bethella, or when you have Nat, or when you have Hammer, or T.T. or Hoover or Michelle, I mean, what was Sextus's wife's name? I forgot.
Elmunda.
Yeah, you have all these people, and I have them in my head. You know, it's like a movie in my head. I can play it. I guess it would be a great movie. But I guess you've already talked about people with that.
No.
Should. I mean, I'm sure they'll be coming to you, I would imagine. But
yeah, I'm not going to try to get ahead of myself as far as any of that is concerned.
It's just that there is a certain cinematic quality to it.
Yeah, a friend of mine called it 12 years ago, a slave.
Well, yeah, it's been there, done that, unfortunately. it does have that quality because the I can see Eddie's face, which I don't often do in a book. In fact, there's a new book out, What Do We See When We Read? And the concept is, okay, when we read Anna Karenina or The Fall of the House of Usher, do we see Anna Karenina's face? No, I don't see her face. Or The Fall of the House of Usher, do you see it sinking into the tarn? Do you see the house? No, I don't.
Kind of, you know, in Anna Karenina, I kind of saw Vronsky because he's sort of my type. Like, there's a description of Vronsky in there who's like, he's like kind of short, dark haired. He's like, wow, I see that guy.
Well, I guess that's true. I guess that's true of people when people envision who would play who. And I don't want to do that with you, but I can see people playing. Well, of course, you have the entire Bush administration playing every character, and they.
Well, that wasn't something I was consciously thinking about as I was writing. I just noticed it later. I was like, oh, that's odd.
Maybe you need to see a therapist about that. I don't know.
Maybe.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you about all this. I really, really enjoyed the book. It was not what I expected. And like you said, you know, it's a breaking your heart kind of book, but it's also a real thinking kind of book. And the fact that it's so close to the truth makes it even more, I guess, I don't know, whatever you say, poignant, I guess. But I really, really enjoyed reading it. Thank you so
Great.
Much.
Great. I'm so glad to hear that.
Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you for having me.
That was James Hanaham talking about his new book, Delicious Foods, which came out in March, published by Little Brown and Company. We were kind of going back and forth there, but it is a book that harkens back to an earlier time that hasn't changed as much as we would like it to have changed. Things still exist, unfortunately, everywhere, but unfortunately sometimes in the South, that shouldn't exist and should be stopped. And that's what this book talks about, but in a very literary, lilting, almost romantic kind of way. And you have, like I said, three characters, although lots of peripheral ones, but three characters, Darlene, Eddie, and the third character, as we said, is inanimate, is the voice of crack, but his name's Scotty. And that's something you don't often see in a book or read in a book where you actually are moved by the portrayal of a character that doesn't really exist in the real world other than as a piece of material of some kind or another. So enough of that. In any event, keep joining us every week. We have, H.W. Brands, who's going to be talking about his, not George Bush, I've been talking about that too much, Ronald Reagan book. Then there's this woman who, Laura Dave, who wrote this book called 800 Grapes. Then we have Lauren Acampora, who wrote The Wonder Garden, which is a great collection of short stories. And Courtney Maum, who wrote another great novel that I probably wouldn't have read because I would have thought it was a chick book, but it wasn't. It's called I'm Having So Much Fun Here Without You. A great book and a great interview, I think, as well from that book. So take a look at what we've got on WellingtonSquareBooks.com, or you can look at WCHE1520.com, or download our podcast at iTunes or Podomatic, and also check out our YouTube channel. And, you know, tons more. Like I said, just Google us and you'll find all that stuff. So thanks as always for joining us, and we look forward to talking with you and talking with our author next week here on The Avid Reader.